Bob Summers, Reel 3. So the preparations for the Rhine crossing. What did you know about the crossing and what did you have to do?
Well, the 53rd Division was not an assault crossing. We were the follow-through troops. And so the morning of the crossing, we moved into a wooded area known as the Hochwald. And we got there at about 10 o'clock in the morning, having gone along from a place called Zanten, along a railway line which had been removed. We ran along the top of where the rails had been, and we stopped in we got there about 10 o'clock in the morning. Beautiful sunny morning. Then at about 11 o'clock, the sky was suddenly full of all these gliders and Dakotas, and it was a most impressive sight. As far as the eye could see and as wide as you could see, it was full of aeroplanes.
How much of a briefing had you had as to what was going to happen all around?
Oh, none.
You knew what you had to do?
No. We knew nothing. We were just told to move our bodies from A to B.
So you were watching?
Watching, yes. But we knew we weren't going through until that night. So this is about 10 or 11 o'clock in the beautiful sunny morning, all these planes in the sky. And every now and then you'd see a Dakota crash to the ground in flames, you know, and you knew jolly well there were 20 or 30 men in that, you know. And a hell of a lot were shot down, and it was really quite something to see. Anyway, they went in and did what they had to do, and then when it got dark, in the meantime, of course, starting at dawn that morning, the other divisions had built bridges, bridges across the river, and that night, as soon as it was dark, we set off in convoy, of course, and crossed the Rhine onto the other side, and bedded down for the night, really, as you might say. We'd not very far, just a few miles over the other side, and then the next morning we moved on again, and of course we had to drive through all this area where the gliders had been landing, and of course 9 out of 10 gliders were completely wrecked on landing. I think this was an accepted situation, and in most cases the men got out perfectly all right and carried on soldiering. That was what they had to do. But the mere fact that a glider's a glider, they 9 times out of 10 wreck on landing, and there were all these wrecked gliders, and I looked in one, and there was a Jeep there, it hadn't been used, but the wheel was broken. So I looked in another one and found a Jeep that had been broken, but the wheel was all right. So I put the one on the other. So from thereafter, I had a Jeep for the rest of the war. And a lot of people did this. Nothing was wasted. And then we sort of proceeded with the... I can't remember too much about what happened. I know we were sort of actively involved doing one thing and another. I remember going to a little bridge over a small river to see whether there was any demolition charges on it. And the Germans were just about had been there trying to blow it up, because I saw the end of the fuse was in a milk bottle, and there were 3 or 4... used matches that hadn't worked properly lying at the side, so we must have got them just in time. Anyway, you know, got the fuse out, got this explosive out, and stopped the little bridge from being blown up. But that's the only thing that sticks out in my mind just at that particular place.
Where did you actually cross the Rhine yourself?
When?
Where?
A place called... I've got all this information down there, you know, which I should...
Let's get your notes then.
Yeah.
So you think it was the Vinnen Bridge?
Yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's where you crossed. How did it feel to actually go over the Rhine after?
Pardon?
How did it feel to actually go over the Rhine? You know, it's a big obstacle.
Oh, I don't know. You just take the... You don't think about anybody. You just say, oh, we're going to go over the bridge, go over the bridge, you know.
Did you... I mean, had you heard much resistance or activity going on from the Germans? Or?
Well, a lot of artillery fire, but apart from that, of course, I say we weren't the attacking. You know, we were only the follow-through troops. So, of course, all the hard work had been done 24 hours before.
Right. So on you went.
So on we went, and we proceeded through. Well, we had lots of things happening.
Like what?
Well, I mean, blown bridges. We had to. We did a lot of bridge work, right. Lifting mines.
So, tell me about the bridge work you did. What were you...
Oh, well, there's a bit of a long story attached to those. Well, we were approaching a place called Rethem, R-E-T-H-E-M. And it was held by the Germans. And there was a bridge there, a very important bridge. And... I don't know where to start, where to finish, really. Anyway.
Tell me all
of
it, then.
Because there was something happened before that, you see.
Right. To get
at this bridge, the Germans holding the far side had to be... It was thought best to attack them, to get... across the river further south, cross the river, and then come down the opposite river bank and attack the Germans from that way. So, one morning I received a message to go somewhere rather rapidly, which I did, which was to a place called Weston.
When you say you, my
merry men, you know, my 64 men, yeah. And there we had to build a folding boat bridge, which was only would take class just lorries, light loads, so that the infantry could get across the river. Well, when we got there, we started off and we were under machine gun fire from the opposite side, and we had to we built this bridge mostly under machine gun fire. And they were I don't think they were Germans, I think they were Hungarians, actually. Were on lining the flood bank on the opposite side of the river. And we did that. And then we'd finished this bridge by about midday. By the grace of God, it had no casualties, which was, I can't understand why. I suppose we... dropped and ran quickly. Anyway, we got this bridge across, and after that, the infantry took over and did whatever the infantry had to do on the far side. And then at about 11 o'clock, I got another wireless message to go down to Rethem, where 244 Field Company was starting to build a Bailey Bridge across this river there, because in the meantime the Germans had blown up the bridge that was there originally. And so we got down there at about midday, I suppose, and the place was being shelled like anything. And my job was to build what they called the landing bay on the far side, which was Bailey Bridge, is a floating Bailey Bridge. The middle part floats on pontoons, and there are two way downs called landing bays, which are probably about 50 or 60 feet long, at either end. And my job was to build the far one, you see. And to do that, we had to keep on crossing the river, and shells were all over the place. And I remember one instance, the Bailey bridging material was supplied by a Canadian unit, a transport unit, and amongst the, of course, the bridging material is a motorboat, to a tug, for moving the rafts about with. And I remember this Canadian, presumably a Canadian, driving this motorboat up the river for some reason or other, and suddenly some shells landed, and he put his hand hard right, and he, at full speed, and he drove straight upon the bank. So that was the end of that machine. But what else do we remember about that? Well, we got shelled off the thing, and in the end, we had to stop, and we went back at night. And so we built this, we went across and built the thing at night, and there's a story which is in our book here, which I told the report for before, is that while we were across there, the CRE, which was the top engineer in the division, came across, and my sergeant was supervising the actual building of the bridge, item by item. And he got his back turned, and he heard somebody say, "I saw," in words of the, "I say, Sergeant, wouldn't it be better to do something, this, that, and the other, you see?" So the sergeant said, he knew jolly well who had a shrewd idea, what, "You know, I don't know who's talking to me," he said, "but I'm in charge of this bridge, bugger off," you see. And the lieutenant colonel did what he was told. That's one of these things you remember. Anyway, that went on, and
so that was quite a difficult and scary sort of operation there. I mean,
oh, it was, yes,
So you stood up to being under fire.
Yes, we were. Actually, there's quite a lot about it. We were shelled there for about 70 hours, I think it was.
Oh, really?
Yes, about three. Somebody counted in one of the books. About 350 shells landed, or something.
Really.
How
difficult a job was it?
Well, it was a typical engineering job. Straight. I mean, it wasn't particularly difficult, except the circumstances, you know. But the trouble was also that all the materials had to be ferried across the river all the time under shell fire to build the thing on the far side. Mm.
Did you take casualties?
No, do you know, we didn't have any. Well, I think the other company building the other part of the bridge, but we didn't actually. We were very, very lucky. I can't think why we didn't. Mm. Mm.
So that took 70 hours then?
Yeah.
A long time. Continuous work?
Pardon?
Working continuously?
Oh, no, because we during the afternoon we decided we'd best pack up and come back at night. Mm. And the powers that be decided that was, from a tactical point of view, was that there, and so that was that. Mm. But of course, you see, as a young officer just doing the work, you don't know anything about high level decisions or anything like that.
So you got the job done.
We got the job done. Mm-hmm. And then there were way other amusing things.
I mean, did all your equipment that you've got and you know, the way you've been taught everything worked well, did it? Or did
you
feel lack of any particular piece of
equipment? No. Well, you had what you got and you used that. I mean, I don't think we ever. Well, no, I can't think about that. Then there was another. The thing that we built lots of bridges and things and culverts. The North German plain is the roads are it's a pretty flat, marshy sort of for mile after the whole area, the whole of North Germany there, and most of the roads are on little embankments, and of course. There were streams, every now and then there would be these culverts to let the streams through, and of course they were all blown, and so they weren't sort of huge bridging jobs, but they were quite a job to do, and you invariably did them somebody firing a gun at you or trying to, and there was one in particular place that I always remember, I don't know why I remember it particularly, but we were told to make good a small blown bridge. And just down the road was a German timber yard, so I thought the best way to do it was, we used to carry what was known as Armco culverting, which was corrugated tubes, really. You would split in half for easy carrying, and you assemble. They could form a tube, big tube, you know, about 18 inches diameter. And so I thought, well, if this stream, if I drop a couple of those in the bottom, we'll fill it up with this timber. So we, I sent the lorries down, and we picked up this timber and built the thing. And all the time we were doing that, we were being mortared by this German Nebelwaffe, or something it was called, this 6-barrel German mortar thing. And the one thing now, every time I see a rugger match, I think of this little situation. But it's quite, if you see a rugger match and somebody kicks a ball between the posts, these rugger balls come over and over and over and over like that. I can't get it out of my... every time I see one of those, my mind goes back to this situation. And the thing is, I think they come up 6 at a time, these things, but you only saw 2. The first 2 attracted your attention. You never saw the other 4 because you were scuttling away trying to get out of it, out of the way, you know. But... anyway, carrying on with this little bridge, it was a bit of a calamity, really, because the first tank that went over it collapsed into things and just filled up the gap, and so the rest of the tanks went straight over the top. And then they got into the field, and by the time, there must have been quite a flow on the river, because the tank filling the gap between the bridge abutments, it stopped the flow of water, and so the meadows on either side started to flood. And a bit later on, when a few tanks went over, they were all bogged down. So it was a real... In the end, they decided the army wouldn't proceed in that area. They proceeded somewhere else. Oh, dear. Yes. I don't know. And there was other occasions too, which are quite interesting. I used to, towards the end of the war, you see, when we were called swanning, there was the whole brigade would be going along the road. It'd probably be 10 or 15 miles long, you know. And they used to start off with the leading infantry company, and then there'd be a section of sappers, and then the rest of the army used to follow. And when I was with platoons and companies took it in turns to be the leading the way. So when my turn came, I was driving on the, used to sit on the top of the armored, company commander's little armored car thing he had, and proceed. And then when we came to an obstruction, either it was just some German in the infantry could deal with it, and he used to whistle up his soldiers to go and deal with it, or if it was a blown culvert, I'd whistle up my merry men and we'd go and deal with it. And that's the way of it. And then what else comes to mind? Churchill tanks, you know, were converted the crocodiles, you know, the old flamethrowers, and really, that was quite a thing to see those in action, you know.
Where did you first see them?
Well, just a place called Ibbenbüren, which is a lot of trouble there, because this Ibbenbüren was a training school for senior German warrant officers and officers. And, of course, when the war reached them, they had to, instead of training, they had to do the fighting themselves. And, of course, they were very good. In fact, twice as good as anybody else. And so there was a lot of trouble there, and I remember seeing these crocodiles flaming the houses, and you know, you think, God, there's some chaps inside there, you know. It's pretty horrible, really. But still, it's part of the act. Yeah, there's nothing very exciting, really. Well, it was the day-to-day stuff.
How well had you got to know your men by now?
Oh, very well. They got. I've never had. Since the war, I was a civil engineering contractor, and of course I employed 90% Irishmen. You see, well, if you can cope with Irishmen, you can cope with anybody. And I've always got on jolly well. I always think the men are very good.
Did you know all your men by name?
Well, by the surname, yeah. Not by, of course, in those days, Christian names never came into it.
No. So, you
know, you... Oh, yes. Oh, they were very good chaps.
And who was your sergeant?
Well, I had three sergeants. Three of them. One was a lance sergeant, and he wasn't as known as a recce. They were very good, very efficient.
Do you remember their names?
I remember the name of one of them, the main one, Wilson. I can't remember the names of the others.
Yeah. And you had them for a long time, did you?
Well, all the while I was there, yes. Yeah. Oh, and they're very efficient, too. I mean, they do the day-to-day running of the whatever's got to be done, you know. And very good. And jolly nice chaps, too.
Had they been out there for a long time?
They'd been with them, I think two of them had been... Because this company that I was with was a TA unit, 53rd Welsh TA unit, which was in existence pre-war. And when the war came, it was sort of expanded into a full-time division. And they'd started off in 1940 in Northern Ireland. And then they'd moved down for about 6 months before D-Day down to Kent. And all these chaps had been with them all that time, so they were real old sweats, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
And I was a new boy. But they were very good and very nice, super chaps. In fact, when I eventually left them, very touching, really. When we finished up in Hamburg and we took over some billets, and of course, then I was what was known as SEAC June Demand, Southeast Asia June Demand, a young chap, you see. Had to go out and carry on the war out there. And they gave me a hell of a party when I left. I've only just got over it, really. Oh, they were grand fellas.
Yeah. Where was the party?
Oh, in somewhere in it's Altona in Hamburg, yeah.
What, in a mess?
I mean, they were singing a song, of course, my name being Summers, you know, and they were singing, good old summertime, you know. they were super chaps.
So what was Hamburg like when you got there?
Oh, terrible. I got photographs I could show you, but...
tell me how it affected
you. Well, it was terrible. The streets were like avenues between piles of rubble. The Germans, after all these raids, they just pushed the stuff back through. And it was a... Oh, it was fantastic, really, the destruction that was there. But surprisingly enough, there was quite a few places not destroyed, which was quite surprising, really. I thought, but the bombing they'd had, but it's certain areas were completely flat. But the worst place, after the end of the war, we moved down to the Ruhr to take over from the Americans. And we drove through Essen, and Essen is... built like a saucer, and as you drove through Essen, of course, it was absolutely flat as far as the eye could see. And as you drove up out over the rim of the saucer, you could see over the whole area, and it was flat. It was incredible how they survived and why they survived. The thing that annoyed us, because about a month before the end of the war, it was obvious the war was going to, it got a finish in only one way. And yet the silly fools were blowing up bridges and doing all sorts of things, causing themselves no end of destruction, which was completely unnecessary. And the German soldiers fighting right to the end. I mean, it was just a giveaway. And the, I mean, at Wrentham there, the German soldiers just were just committed suicide, really. It's talk about the kamikaze pilots. It was for hundreds of these young German chaps. It was terrible, really. But on the other hand, they were the enemy, and they had to be shot, sort of thing, you know. But the Germans really, well, why they didn't get rid of that man sooner, God only knows.
I mean, you didn't lose any men then?
No.
Up to this point?
No, I was very incredible.
You were a lucky one.
Yes, I say, I arrived at the right... Strangely enough, we got involved in all sorts of situations. But I think we had a few minor casualties, you know, but absolutely nothing serious.
Right.
It's incredible.
So where did you first sort of encounter death on your sojourn in Europe?
Encounter what?
Death.
Oh.
Did you see, you know, a dead British soldier?
Well, of course, it's just after crossing the Rhine. Mm-hmm. It came, there were a lot of sort of dead Germans the other side of the Rhine.
Did that affect you, you know, the sort of first time you sort of came in contact with them?
No, I was interested more than affected.
Mm.
But the thing that affected me in that respect was that when we, just after we sort of proceeded over the Rhine, on the far side of the Rhine, about a mile over the other side of the river, was another forest. And a lot of the chaps in the... parachutists, when they descended, got themselves caught on the trees, and they'd obviously been shot while they were dangling there, you know, and there were quite a few sort of those hanging around, you know, still. I mean, we were only there the next morning, you see, and that, I think, was the thing that I thought, you poor, you know, there. That was bad.
Yes. Yeah. So you sound as though you were quite just a family.
Well, strangely enough,
yeah.
At engineers, the most diverse crowd. I mean, I'd got my band of men, and we were virtually on our own from the time I started to the time I finished.
Mm.
We occasionally saw the company commander of the 2IC. I occasionally went to wherever they were, because for one reason or another. But as a group, and the other companies in the other three companies, there were three companies in the divisional engineers, three companies, and a field park company, that's four all told. Never saw any of those. They were all, you see, the division is divided into brigades, and one company was allocated to each brigade, and they were there, they were there, and they were there.
Mm.
And so you'd very seldom met up. It was only after the war, I believe, of course, after which they got back to peacetime arrangement and all got together.
Yeah.
But while the war was on, we never saw each other. And I say I very seldom saw even our own company HQ. I was on my own for the whole time.
Yeah. Did you have any contact with any other units? You know, not of engineers.
Not really, no.
No, you were always quite independent, really.
Yes, it was a little independent army.
Yeah.
Mm.
So how effective were communications? You were kept well informed of what you should be doing.
Well, you see, you don't know how... When you're ignorant, you don't know how ignorant you are. You got certain things. You don't know whether you should have had more or less, you see. I mean, you got your instructions, the orders to do this, that and the other.
Yeah, so they were constantly in touch with
you.
Oh,
yes. Oh, well, I'd got a... couple of wireless chappies, and the back of my half track was the wireless set up. And we had all the information we want, but it was only just to do with what you've got to do. And of course, there was a case of rations and supplies. That was we got to know where to pick those up from, and all that sort of thing.
Right.